Great. Thank you very much, Bruno. Yeah, I apologize for not being here more. I had really hoped to be a very regular participant, but this is my first time in 20 years to have a sabbatical, so I've been up at Stanford for the last couple of months. And I guess I can't be everywhere at the same time. But still, it's a pleasure to be here today and to see everybody. So the topic of double diffusive sedimentation is perhaps a little bit outside the core focus of this program, but I hope that maybe you'll still see a couple of things that you might find interesting. So I'll briefly go over the motivation for this work and the governing equations, and then talk about some physical results that tell us something about double diffusive sedimentation, and then present also some scaling analysis. So our motivation comes from these so-called coastal margin processes. So we're interested in river outflows. River typically carry sediment with them, and when the river flows into the ocean, most of the time the combination of fresh water and sediment is lighter than the salt water of the ocean, and so as a result, the river carrying the sediment flows along the surface of the ocean above the salt water below. And we're then interested in the processes by which the sediment settles out of this buoyant river plume and reaches the seafloor here. This is a very small but important part of what is known as the global sediment cycle. So the global sediment cycle, you can think of it as starting in the mountains where, due to weathering and so on, the rock breaks apart and small bits and pieces of rocks get transported into the creeks. The creeks collect them, transport them into the larger rivers. The rivers carry them into the coastal ocean. And so that's what is shown here. And then we get these sediment deposits, typically on the continental shelf. And every once in a while, this sediment deposit on the continental shelf goes unstable, forms an underwater avalanche or turbidity current, which then travels down the continental slope into the deep ocean. And it can travel very far along the seafloor, up to 1,000 kilometers. And then eventually it gets deposited there, forms sedimentary rock, and then the tectonic motion turns the sedimentary rock again into mountains, right? So that's the global sediment cycle. And so understanding the processes by which the sediment reaches the coastal ocean is one important aspect of that. So if we look at this in a conceptual way, we can draw the following sketch here. So we have here the seafloor, and then we have the river. So again, consisting of fresh water and sediment flowing into the ocean. The salt water of the ocean is denser than the combination of fresh water and sediment. And so as a result, typically the river stays along the surface of the ocean. So we want to focus on this area here where we have now fresh water and sediment above salt water. So if we look at the density profile, it looks something like this. So this is our vertical direction. We have down here the dense salt water, and then up here the lighter combination of fresh water and sediment. And at first glance, you might think, well, since the sediment and the fresh water is lighter than the salt water, this must be a stable situation and not much of interest might be happening here. Well, as it turns out, actually, there are a few interesting things going on, and there are various ways in which this system can go unstable. One of these ways in which the system can go unstable is related to the idea of double diffusion. So we know that salt is, of course, a scalar that has a certain diffusivity associated with it in the water. And we can also think of the sediment as a first approximation as being another scalar that has another diffusivity associated with it, typically a very small diffusivity. So think of it then in the following way. Take a parcel here of fresh water and sediment and perturb that into the salt water layer down here. Then what happens is, because the salt now has a much larger diffusivity than the sediment, you have the salt diffusing inwards much faster than you have the sediment moving, diffusing outwards. And so as a result, very soon, you'll have salt inside this fluid parcel as well, and the sediment is still stuck in there as well. So this parcel will still be denser than its environment, and so it'll keep sinking. So that's the idea of double diffusion, and that's how double diffusion can destabilize a density profile that looks overall stable. Double diffusion is, of course, an idea that has been around for a long time and has been explored in quite a bit of detail, typically in the context of heat and salinity. So that's the so-called thermohaline case. So in the ocean, often we have, at the top of the ocean, a layer that is warmer and saltier. Below, it's colder and somewhat less salty. The reason, of course, is that the surface layers of the ocean get heated up by the sun's radiation, and so we have evaporation there. And because the evaporation takes away fresh water and leaves salt behind, that's why we have a higher salt concentration along the top of the ocean than at the bottom. And so this double diffusive system then of warm and salty water above cold and fresh water can give rise to these thermohaline fingers, which have been shown to play an important role in the vertical transport in the ocean. And so we want to extend this idea now to sediment and see if we replace one of these two, either heat or salinity, with sediment, what changes in the system. So there were some laboratory experiments done about 15 years ago by Parsons, Bush, and Savitsky, and they looked at exactly this conceptual situation. So they looked at fresh water and sediment above salt water, and if they looked at very small sediment grains, so maybe on the order of 10 microns or so, then they saw this space-filling instability developing here, which they termed the fingering mode, and that looks quite similar to these thermohaline fingers that I showed before, so quite similar to the heat and salt situation. On the other hand, if they looked at somewhat larger sediment grains, so maybe on the order of 100 microns or so, then they saw a quite different pattern, which they called the leaking mode, and that's what we see here. And so here we have much more isolated structures. And if we look at this in an animated fashion, then we will actually see that these structures tend to move back and forth along the interface, so they're not steady in the same location. So there seem to be two different... Okay, so
it happens sometimes.
Okay, let's come back on.
But before you continue, the thermohaline case, all right. There is sort of the diffusivity of viscosity, and there is the diffusivity of the temperature and the salt concentration.
Right.
And here the corresponding numbers would be the diffusivities of these small particles in there.
Yeah, salt and small particles.
How does that compare number-wise?
Sorry, what?
What are the numbers? The diffusivities of the particles relative to that, the corresponding quantity.
That depends on the sediment particle size. So there are some empirical relations that relate an effective diffusivity to the grain size. And for different grain sizes, you get different diffusivities. And you can actually get diffusivities that are both larger and smaller than that of salt.
Why is it an effective diffusivity that matters? Right, the molecular diffusivity of salt would be much higher than sediment. Just because salt's smaller by orders of magnitude.
Well, that's true, but let me see. I think what gives you the effective diffusivity is the interaction among the sediment grains. So that leads to some additional effects.
Actually, I'm not sure about the ratios. You talk about the thermohaline case, it's the ratio of the thermal diffusivity to the molecular diffusivity, which is a large spread there.
That's so about 100, I think.
About 100. So in this case, is it similarly about 100, except now
the salt is faster. Yes, that's right.
But similarly about more than 100 or so?
Well, again, it depends on the grain size. It depends on the grain size somehow. So there are some empirical relations around. Of course, it's a very idealized model to consider sediment as a diffusing scalar. But the empirical models that are around in order to estimate these diffusivities, they indicate quite a wide range depending on the grain size.
Also, there's gravity acting on the sediments, which is messing it all up.
Yes, that's also, I'm going to be talking about that, yes. So what the experiments here show is that there seem to be two different modes by which the system can develop. And so far what we've seen is, one possibility in which the system can go unstable is the idea of double diffusion, but we haven't talked at all yet about the fact that sediment has a settling velocity associated with it, right, as a result of gravity. So let's look at what that will do. So again, initially we have just fresh water and sediment up here, and then we have salt water down here, but now the sediment settles, think of just Stokes settling velocity, and so as a result, at the boundary between fresh water and salt water, you will have particles settling into the top of the saltwater layer, so that at the top of the saltwater layer, you have what we call this nose region, which now has both salinity and sediment. And so that means this layer here will now be denser than the pure salt layer below. And so as a result, here you really do have an unstable density profile, and so there's a possibility for a Rayleigh-Taylor instability to develop right here, right? So it seems then that we have these two possibilities, either a double diffusive instability or a Rayleigh-Taylor instability, and this Rayleigh-Taylor instability is, of course, the new aspect. That's something that doesn't happen in a thermohaline system, and so what we want to see is how does the possibility that we can have a Rayleigh-Taylor instability, how does that change the picture of double diffusion as compared to the thermohaline case? So we want to look at this both in terms of linear stability analysis and also nonlinear simulations. In order to do so, we make certain assumptions. First of all, we consider the volume fraction of the particles to be fairly small, on the order of 10 to the minus 3 or less. That means that the effect of the particles on the fluid continuity equation is negligible. We also assume that the particle radius is much less than the particle separation, which is essentially a consequence of this first assumption, so that we don't have any direct collisions among particles. And we assume that the particles are relatively small and have small inertia, so that the particles, for example, don't get ejected out of vortex cores and so on. We can then model the particles as having essentially the velocity of the fluid phase plus a superimposed Stokes settling velocity, right? So in that way, then, we can model our suspension in a quite simple way. So as I mentioned, we neglect the effect of the particles on the continuity equation, so we still have the incompressible continuity equation. And then we treat the suspension essentially as a single fluid where the density, the local density, is related to the local concentration of the sediment, right? So and it's being done similarly to how you would just treat salt water, where the density is related to the salinity locally here. We treat the density as being a function locally of salinity and sediment concentration. And as I mentioned, we assume that the particles follow the fluid motion and have a superimposed settling velocity. So our system of equations then in dimensionless form is given here. So we have this is already made dimensionless, so we have our density being equal to the fluid density plus a contribution related to the salinity concentration and a contribution related to the sediment concentration. Our incompressible continuity equation, and then the momentum equation, where here we have the density term, and so any flow is driven by variation in the local density by any density gradients. Then we have a convection diffusion equation for the salinity and a convection diffusion equation for the sediment concentration, where again you see we assume that the sediment moves with the fluid velocity and it also has the superimposed Stokes settling velocity, right? So that's our system of equations. And since we don't have any external length scales here, we make everything dimensionless with internal scales. And so we get four dimensionless parameters. First of all, there's the dimensionless settling velocity of the particles. then the so-called stability ratio. The stability ratio just tells us the ratio of the salinity the salinity contribution to the density divided by the sediment contribution to the density. So this ratio is always larger than 1 because there's always more of a salinity density than sediment density. Yeah?
If you had to make the assumption that Vp is given basically by sailing velocity, you would have just one more equation coupled to all this, right? With the maxi-ID or something.
Yes, that's right, but that would lead to the problem that then we wouldn't have then we wouldn't have a continuous field of sediment concentration described, but then we would track particles individually in a Lagrangian fashion, right? Yes. And then we have the Schmidt number here, so ratio of viscosity to salinity diffusivity. And the diffusivity ratio, so the ratio of salinity diffusivity to sediment diffusivity. So I want to show you some simulation results. Let me first show you some still pictures here. So this is a time sequence from top to bottom. In the left column, we show the sediment concentration field. So initially, we have all the sediment up here in black. White indicates no sediment. And then in the right column, we have the salinity. And so initially, all the salinity is down here. And then later, it gets mixed. So you can see how this interface initially becomes unstable. These initial instabilities grow. They interact with each other, form larger plumes. And these larger plumes move downwards here. Now, this would be plumes that contain both salinity and sediment. And this would be upward moving plumes that contain neither salinity nor sediment. So we see a vigorous instability developing here. By the way, this is for relatively small sediment grains and for a diffusivity ratio of 25. So now let me show you a movie that shows some of these simulation results. So again, here's our initial configuration in 3D. Initially, sediment up here, salinity down here, and then we perturb the interface with a random perturbation in order to trigger an instability. And let's now look at what happens. So this is a 2D simulation. These are frames similar to what I showed you before. So here on the left, we have the sediment. Here on the right, we have the salinity. And you can see how this instability grows and how we get these upward and downward propagating plumes. We can also look at vorticity and density perturbations. And in 2D, of course, what we see is that each plume generates a vorticity dipole, similar to what we know from other buoyancy-driven flows. So all the vorticity here is being generated as a result of baroclinic vorticity generation. We can look at this whole thing in 3D as well. And you see that the situation in 3D is quite similar. Again, plumes moving both upwards and downwards. We can see that the concentration contours are much sharper in the sediment field than in the salinity field because of the smaller molecular diffusivity. Now, if we look at a horizontal crosscut near the initial interface location, we can see these very localized plumes that are essentially moving upwards and downwards, right? Here we can see them in the sediment, in the salinity concentration field. So localized plumes moving upwards and downwards. All right, so we think that this mechanism might be...
Question?
Yes?
In the movie, it seemed that for the sediment and for the salt concentration, sort of the Lederer scales were different.
Because of the difference in molecular diffusivity, right? So the salt concentration contours smear out much more rapidly, whereas the sediment concentration contours remain much sharper, much more localized, because they don't diffuse so easily.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, but it's the same velocity field that sort of carries them.
Right, that's right.
Eckhart?
So we feel that this mechanism, what? Oh, sorry, yes.
Just back to the your previous simulation. So what was the initial condition for the density profiles? What I can imagine is that you might have sediment build up at the interface, and mm-hmm. then have a Rayleigh-Taylor type instability. Is that what was happening in those cases?
No, that was not happening.
Okay.
The initial density profile here was such that the density contribution of the salinity was twice that of the sediment concentration, and so in this case we did not have any buildup. But you're going in the right direction, and we'll discuss that idea later on. Yes. So what we're suggesting is that this mechanism might not be limited to just sediment in a buoyant river plume, but also, for example, to a certain class of clouds, Mammatus clouds, and that's a topic that Rama and I are looking at. Here, of course, we don't have sediment, but we have water droplets, and we don't have salinity gradients, but we have gradients in heat and gradients in water vapor. So again, we have, on one hand, particles in the form of raindrops here moving or settling through density gradients of another scalar. And so perhaps that's the reason why these structures here that we see, these lobe-like structures, are somewhat similar to what we saw in the simulation before. Set of environmental conditions where this kind of instability might occur is shown here. So here we have a volcanic ash plume. So we have warm air, warm gas carrying volcanic ash up through the atmosphere until it reaches roughly its level of buoyancy, and then it spreads out radially. And so again, what we have then here are very small particles of ash that have a settling velocity associated with them, and they're in some background density gradient related to temperature, for example. And so one might expect that similar mechanisms may occur here as well. So in order to make some progress quantitatively from these simulation results, what we do now is we average our quantities in horizontal planes. So we take the 3D simulation, we average in horizontal planes, for example, the sediment concentration and also the salinity concentration. And that gives us then one-dimensional profiles in the Z direction. And we can then show the development of these one-dimensional profiles as a function of time. So this is the one-dimensional sediment concentration profile. Initially at time t equals zero, all the sediment is on top, all the fluid down here is without sediment. And then we see how this effective interface spreads, and we see here also these lines going up and down, and that of course indicates the effect of these plumes that are propagating upwards and downwards. By the way, up here you can see up at the very top, of course, the sediment is settling just with Stokes settling velocity. So this gives you an idea of the effect of Stokes settling over this time of 500. And you can see that these convective processes by which these plumes move up and down move much more rapidly than the Stokes settling velocity. Right? Here, the corresponding result for the salinity. And again, because the salinity has a much larger diffusivity in this case, you can see that these horizontally averaged profiles are spread out much more, so you cannot see the traces of individual plumes as clearly as you can see here in the sediment concentration field. So now that we have these one-dimensional profiles, we can actually fit them with error functions. So for the sediment concentration field, we have up here concentration 1, down here 0. For the salinity, it's 0 up here and 1 down here. And we can now fit them at every instant in time with an error function. And that gives us then a thickness of the error function, right? So we can use that as a thickness of the sediment concentration or salinity profile. And also where the inflection point is, that tells us something about where the salinity interface is or where the sediment interface is. So Here I just show these fits with the error function profiles. So you can see here the dashed lines are the error function profiles. The solid lines are the instantaneous numerical profiles. And so you can see that these fits work reasonably well. And they give us a thickness of the profile as a function of time and the location of the inflection point. So that means we have an effective thickness and an effective interface location. And if we plot those now as a function of time, here the interface thickness, we see that after some initial transient, the numerical results, which are the solid lines, show roughly a behavior that's proportional to the square root of time. So these dashed lines here indicate fits that are proportional to the square root of time. So we see that effectively these interfacial thickness regions, they spread diffusively with time. What's interesting is that the sediment interface thickness grows much more rapidly than the salinity interface thickness, even though, as you remember, the diffusivity, the molecular diffusivity of the salinity was much larger than that of the sediment, right? So what that shows you is that the growth of this effective interface thickness is dominated by turbulent diffusion rather than by molecular diffusion, right? Here we plot the center of the error function as a function of time, and we can see that the sediment the sediment interface location moves downward. If it were to move downward with the Stokes settling velocity, then it would move along this dashed line. And it does so initially, but then as soon as the instability set in, then it deviates from that Stokes velocity and settles more slowly, but it still settles on average with time. And the salinity now moves up slightly with time. So that means we do, in fact, generate this nose region here, as I called it. So this region that contains both salinity and sediment, right? Because the sediment is everywhere above this interface. The salinity is everywhere below this interface. And so this is our nose region.
It's the thickness, too. Coincides with the thickness.
So this coincides with, this is the thickness of the nose region, yes. Mm-hmm. And so out of these fits with the square root of time, we can now back out an effective turbulent diffusivity of the sediment field and of the salinity field. And we see, indeed, the sediment field has a higher turbulent diffusivity than the salinity field. And that's why the sediment interface thickness grows more rapidly than that of the salinity. Now, a couple of other interesting things that we can learn from these simulations. So here, this is the ratio of the turbulent diffusivities. And we see that the sediment turbulent diffusivity is roughly twice that of the salinity turbulent diffusivity. And consequently, the ratio of the interface thicknesses grows with the square root of 2, so roughly 1.4. An interesting quantity is this gamma here. Let me tell you what that means. So you remember, initially, we have what looks like a stable density profile, right? We have fresh water and sediment, which together is lighter than the salt water. So we have fresh water and sediment above salt water. So the question is, what drives the instability that we observe here? Well, what drives the instability is the potential energy that's being released by the unstably stratified sediment. Remember, we have sediment only on top, and so that unstably stratified sediment concentration field, that can now release potential energy. And so that potential energy drives everything. And so what gamma shows us here is the fraction of the potential energy released by the sediment field that is being captured by the salinity field, because these instabilities, of course, lift up the salinity field on average, because we have these upward moving plumes of salinity. And so we see here that roughly maybe about two-thirds of the potential energy that's released by the sediment field is used to increase the potential energy of the salinity field. whereas the remaining third goes into the kinetic energy and eventually into dissipation. So an interesting quantity then is, what is the thickness of this nose region where we have salt and sediment compared to the overall interface thickness of the salinity? And what we find here is that this ratio is, for this simulation that we showed, is about 0.1, which means that this sketch here is really not appropriate, because this interface thickness here should really be embedded in a salinity interface thickness that is much larger than this nose region, right? So that means we have this nose region here sitting in a much larger salinity interface region. And as a result, we have sediment concentration gradients and salinity gradients both in the same locations, and that means double diffusive effects remain important. Right? Another interesting question then is, what is the effective settling velocity? So again, we do the horizontal averaging in our 3D simulation, the averaging of the vertical sediment flux. And if we divide that by the local sediment concentration, then we get an effective downward velocity of the sediment. And we can plot that now as a function of time and as a function of the vertical component. And you see that in this region here, the graph is dominated by the color blue, which means that we have an effective settling velocity roughly on the order of 1. 1 is, of course, the buoyancy velocity of the system here, whereas the dimensionless settling velocity of the particles, that was 0.04. So you can see that the effective settling velocity is given by the buoyancy velocity of the system rather than by the Stokes settling velocity. So that means when we model the sedimentation process in a river plume, we probably want to look at the overall system and its buoyancy velocity rather than at the Stokes settling velocity of individual particles. Okay, so that was all for relatively small sediment grains. Now let's look at a simulation with larger sediment grains, and we can simply make these larger sediment grains by looking at a larger Stokes settling velocity. And you remember, we're interested now in the question, can we get these very concentrated structures that Parsons, Busch, and Savitsky had observed? So first of all, the one big difference is we essentially don't have any upward moving plumes anymore. We only have downward moving plumes. Only if we plot some very sensitive concentration contours can we still see upward motion, but mostly here the movement is downwards. This shows these structures both seen from above and from below. And what's interesting now is when we cut again through a horizontal interface and we look at sediment and salinity, we see that they start out as localized plumes, but then they undergo this transition to a structure that looks much more like a web rather than individual plumes, right? Let's look at this again. So first of all, much more activity down here than there is up here. We see more localized structures. And then when we look at the crosscut in this plane here, you will see that initially the instability starts out by in the form of many localized plumes, but then we see a topological transition to something that looks much more sheet-like and web-like. So here you see that initially plumes, but then they reconnect into these sheet-like structures. So this is quite different from what we had seen before. And now you can imagine when you put a light sheet through these sheet-like structures, then you see very localized structures, and that's what we see, what we think that Parsons, Busch, and Savitsky saw. So here again, a picture of these crosscuts as time increases. We start out with localized plumes, and then we see this more sheet-like structure. And now you can imagine if you cut through here with a light sheet, then you see just these very localized phenomena here. There's also an interesting difference that we can see in the analysis of the Fourier modes. So if we look at the case for the small particles, and we plot as a function of the Fourier mode number the phase of the Fourier mode, then we see that this does not seem to be very correlated. Whereas for the mode with the larger sediment grains, we see that initially it's also not very much correlated. But then as time increases, we see a very strong correlation occurring here. And so there seems to be some kind of a phase locking. I'm not sure I fully understand this phenomenon yet, but there's something interesting happening here in the phase relation of the different Fourier modes that seems to lead to this leaking instability. Now, we want to extract some scaling relationships, and let me just show you the final result that we get here. So what we are plotting here is, again, this ratio of the nose height, so the nose thickness, so the region between the two interfaces where we have salt and sediment, as so the ratio of that to the salinity interface thickness. And we plot that as a function of this dimensionless grouping here, which can be interpreted as the ratio the ratio of particles moving into the nose region from above by Stokes settling to the flux of particles moving out of the nose region below through the interfacial instability. And so we can see that if we scale things in this way, all the simulations collapse on a straight line. Simulations for different Schmidt numbers, for different particle settling velocities, for different stability ratios, and so on. And so we see that everything collapses here onto that straight line. And that allows us to come up with a physical interpretation of what's happening. So we can think of this side of the axis here as corresponding to small sediment grains, and here we have large sediment grains. So what happens when we have small sediment grains, when we're over here? Well, small sediment grains settle slowly into the nose region from above. As a result, the inflow, the influx of sediment from above is fairly small. And this influx of particles from above can easily be gotten rid of by the nose region towards the lower fluid layer by a traditional double diffusive instability. As a result, there's not much accumulation of sediment in the nose region, so that the ratio of nose thickness to salinity interface thickness remains pretty small here. On the other hand, if we have larger sediment grains, well, they settle into the nose region much more rapidly from above. So we have a much larger influx of particles from above. This larger influx of particles from above cannot be balanced by a traditional double diffusive outflux to below. So as a result, sediment accumulates in the nose region. The ratio of nose region to salinity interface thickness grows until this nose region has gotten thick enough so that we can trigger a Rayleigh-Taylor instability. And that then balances the influx from above. So I think that's exactly what you were referring to earlier. So for larger sediment grains, we do get this accumulation of sediment near the interface until we form a layer that's thick enough with sediment so that it overturns and forms a Rayleigh-Taylor instability. So that's our physical interpretation, which I've given here. And so that brings me to the summary then. So we've looked at this double diffusive sedimentation system, we've seen that there are essentially two different mechanisms that can cause instabilities here. One is double diffusion, the other one is sedimentation by triggering this nose region formation and Rayleigh-Taylor instability. We saw that the effective settling velocity of the particle scales with the buoyancy velocity of the system rather than with the Stokes velocity. And then we saw this difference for small sediment grains and large sediment grains. For small sediment grains, we have a system that's much more similar to the traditional thermohaline system. Double diffusion dominates, whereas for larger sediment grains, we get this accumulation of sediment in the interfacial region until we get a Rayleigh-Taylor instability, which causes everything to turn over and then to settle out more drastically. All right, thank you very much.
So in back to your motivating problem with the sort of the sediment coming from, I guess, from rivers and river deltas, seems like to me that this notion of it being really dilute is, I don't know, how realistic is that? Because I would think that you would have particle collisions, you'd have agglomeration, flocculation, that sort of thing be important at the river, like muddy Mississippi, you know, these sorts of things. So I'm not sure that this is like a pretty dilute.
Well, when you think about it, so salinity typically contributes on the order of 4% to the density of the ocean water, and so when we have a buoyant river outflow, that means sediment should contribute less than the 4% to the density, and so sediment, of course, having a density that's 2.5 or 3 times that of the density of the water, if that should contribute only less than 4% to the overall density, that means the volume fraction has to be very, very small. But what you say is right. There can be exceptional conditions, especially in the tropical regions where you have steep rivers coming off some steep mountain ranges. They carry tons of sediment, and they can become so concentrated that they're actually denser than the salt water of the ocean. And so in that case, you would have what is called a hyperpycnal river outflow. So then right away the sediment-laden river water flows along the bottom of the ocean rather than along the top of the ocean. So that's, of course, a different situation. The other thing that you mentioned, you were talking about flocculation. So that relates to the idea of cohesive sediment, where particles come together and form larger particles. This was for non-cohesive sediment. But we're currently also looking at cohesive sediment where you have some interparticle forces, and that again can add another level of complication to this. So those are all interesting points. Yes. Yes?
So maybe sort of more along the lines of, you know, factors complicating the problem. The water in the ocean is probably somewhat colder than the water from the river, so does temperature.
That's another thing that can happen. So you can have a temperature difference on top, and that of course means that you can have a triple diffusive system rather than a double diffusive system, right? Or you can also think of this as being relevant for lakes. So for example, when you have the Colorado River flowing into Lake Mead, you know, those are both bodies of water that don't have much salt, so we can forget about the salt. But now in this case, we'll have a double diffusive system because of the sediment and the temperature, right? So that's certainly true. I mean, of course, an obvious simplification is here that we were looking at monodisperse sediment. So we assumed that we only had one grain size of sediment in our system, so that we had one well-defined settling velocity. In reality, of course, you have a distribution of grain sizes and a distribution of settling velocities, so you wouldn't expect to see one of these modes very clearly in isolation, right?
So we're speaking of the river flowing into the ocean, shear forces or velocity differences relevant?
Yes, that of course is another thing that will happen, that you know, here we were just looking at fluid that's initially at rest, but when you have shear across the interface, then you can generate Kelvin-Helmholtz instabilities, or in conjunction with these density differences, Homebow instabilities. And so that's another thing that we're currently looking at, how that will change things. Yes. So in many ways, this is a first step. Kong, yes.
So the various processes you identify are processes that locally increase the concentration of particles. you know, you get the leaking modes or the Rayleigh-Taylor. Is there ever a possibility that you end up in a situation where even if you start off with a dilute picture, you end up with regions where that diluteness, by the very dynamics of what's happening, breaks down and you'll have hindered settling, or just the concentrations of the particles will get so large, non-Boussinesq effects or something?
Well, not within this framework, because you remember, we assume that the particles move with a fluid velocity, plus they have a superimposed settling velocity, which is a constant, right? So if you form the divergence of the particle velocity field, you still have an incompressible flow field. So that means the particle concentration does not increase locally. The only thing that can happen is it can decrease locally as a result of diffusion, right? But there's no, as long as we neglect particle inertia, there's no mechanism that can lead to an increase in particle concentration. If we have particle inertia so that particles can get thrown out of vortices and accumulate in stagnation point regions, then I think your idea becomes much more relevant. And that's something that I perhaps wouldn't necessarily expect in water sediment systems, but maybe more in powder snow avalanches, where you have particles that are now much denser than the surrounding fluid. And so as a result, you cannot neglect inertia, and then you can have local accumulation much more. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wanted to ask about the Stokes drift bifurcation, or Stokes drift, is a sort of terminal velocity of the sphere.
Right.
So is its inclusion as an additive term, just an additive term in the concentration? I forget where it came in.
Right, into the concentration.
Okay. So just generally, I'm kind of, well, want to ask you, is the way it's included like a dynamically valid way, or is it an approximation, or?
It's an approximation in the sense that we neglect particle inertia.
Yeah.
So if we neglect particle inertia, that means the balance that decides the particle trajectory is the balance of the buoyancy forces, right? So gravitational force, which wants to bring the particle down, make it settle through the fluid, and then the retarding effect of the viscous fluid forces acting on the surface of the particle. But if you take that as your dominant balance, then this is exact.
Well, I mean, there's another problem, right? So you have, in principle, entrainment of the fluid by particles, so you also can have an instability due to the effect of the sediment particles on the float.
Wait, can you say that again?
So you also have the effect of the sediment particles on the float.
Right.
Right, so you have, let's say, a clump of particles, and around that, the fluid is actually being dragged with the particles, but then there's an upflow of fluid around it.
Right.
So that technically, it's probably an approximation that's good enough.
Well, so that is captured here, right? Because when we have, let's say a bunch of particles here, these particles will, through their density, they will exert a gravitational force onto the fluid, which moves the fluid downwards, and so that's that creates then the recirculation. So that is accounted for.
Compressibility takes care of the recirculation, you're saying.
So essentially, modeling the suspension as a variable density fluid, that takes account of the coupling between the particles and the fluid, again, in the limit of negligible inertia.
So where does this continuum approximation for the sediments break down? When do you have to start considering individual particles? That must be a function of the size of them.
Right, that's right. So it's a function of the Stokes number. The Stokes number tells us something about a particle time scale relative to the fluid time scale. So if the particle time scale is much smaller than the fluid time scale, that means you can neglect the particle inertia, and that's when this is valid. But if the particle time scale becomes larger than the fluid time scale, that means the particle cannot react quickly enough to changes in the flow field, and so it cannot follow the motion of vortices, for example, and that's when this formulation no longer is valid.
And when do particle interactions become important?
Oh, that's a function of the volume fraction. Yes. So actually, particle interactions do become important at fairly low volume fractions. So I think already, if you're at more than 0.1%, then you do have particle interactions.
Questions? Thank you very much again. Yes.